In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about the war in Iraq and trying to talk a little bit about the war and how it was conducted and why, the politics behind it, and a little bit about where things stand right now, a kind of a recap. And our guest for the program is Todd Purdom. He works in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times and has worked for the Times for more than 20 years. He is a former diplomatic correspondent, White House correspondent. He was the Los Angeles Bureau chief. He now makes his home in Washington, D.C. He's the author of a book that's just been published by Times Books, which is entitled A Time of Our Choosing, America's War in Iraq, which in part draws on the reporting done by other people in the Times, but also is an original work by Todd Purdom. It's not merely a collection of dispatches from the Times. It's his looking at that story, taking advantage of the reporting the Times did, but trying to put it together in a package so that people can get an overview of the war. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana. Even if you were listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you could use the toll-free. That's 800-222-9455. And again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We'd certainly welcome callers. The only thing we ask is that people are brief so that we can keep moving and get in as many callers as possible. Anybody's welcome to call. Mr. Purdom, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
We certainly appreciate it. I guess one of the things that I would like to start out talking about is something of the politics behind the decision to go to war in the first place. And it gets difficult because in the run-up to the war, the administration, different members of the administration at different times said different things. And also that I think people in their thinking about the war, it's easier to try to grab onto one thing as an answer to that question: why did the United States make the decision to go to war in Iraq? And I think that it is more the case that there is not one reason. There are a number of reasons that all wove together in the decision. Some of them may have carried a little bit more weight than others, but that makes it very difficult, it seems to me, very difficult to answer that question: why did the United States make this decision?
I quite agree. I think there are a number of rationales, and they all came blending together over a period of several months. There were also a number of moments. I have had a very hard time, despite diligent reporting by myself and my colleagues at the Times, pinpointing a single moment when the president and his advisors made an irrevocable decision to go to war. It's clear that in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, Iraq rose again to the top of the administration's consideration in a way that it hadn't before. President Bush clearly felt the United States could no longer afford to wait to confront risks from abroad. Only after we were attacked, we would have to act first. And at some point during the ensuing 15, 16 months, policymakers and decision makers gathered all sorts of reasons, and that's what wound up leading us into battle. It's a complicated thing because, as you say, whether you're a proponent or an opponent of the war, you could seize on one or two of the potential reasons and say, well, this is a valid reason, or this was a phony reason. It's really more complicated than that, and I think that's one of the things that will make historians grapple with this war for quite a long time to come.
Mm-hmm. The administration has said, certainly recently, quite clearly, that they feel that the war in Iraq is part of what they are calling the war on terror. And they have tried to associate in the minds of Americans the terrorist attacks of September 11th with Saddam Hussein and the war in Iraq, and have been very successful in that. Just recently, I think I heard there was a recent poll, if I'm remembering right, this was USA Today, done recently, then that found that something over half, and again, as I remember it, I hope I'm remembering this right, 53% of Americans that they in their samples said that they believe that somehow Saddam Hussein had something to do with September 11th. I know other people would be quick to point out, no, that that's not correct. Is there, to the best of everyone's knowledge and what their information there is publicly available, any connection between Saddam Hussein and the attacks of September 11th or the Al-Qaeda network?
No, not a clear cut. Certainly no known connection between Saddam Hussein and the attacks of September 11th. What it does seem clear that there is a connection between is September 11th and the American attack on Saddam Hussein. That there's no question that our being attacked on that September 11th at the World Trade Center in the Pentagon changed President Bush's thinking about what was acceptable and changed his thinking about what the American military needed to do around the world to demonstrate America's resolve. So that is a link. In terms of Saddam, Al-Qaeda is a religious fundamental organization. Saddam had made his reputation as a secular Arab leader. There were some links between a group in the north of Iraq called Ansar al-Islam, which apparently has some links to Al-Qaeda. Saddam had had some links with those folks, stirring up trouble in the north of Iraq. But it's far from clear that that Saddam himself had any links to Al-Qaeda, or indeed that he was, behind any of this or cooperating with those kind of fundamentalists.
Mm-hmm. Then I want to go a little further here. I have a person who is on hold, and I want to promise that person I'm not going to make them wait forever. But just to go a little further on along this road of how is it that the administration thought about this war? It also seems to be the case that even before September 11th, there were people in the administration that were thinking broadly about what America's role on the world stage should be, and about the fact that they felt that America had the ability and perhaps even the duty to try to remake the world in its image, and that they saw Iraq as being a perfect test case for that, which draws in a number of other threads, including the administration's position on preemptive war, the idea that possibly if we did this, it would in the long run be good for peace in the Middle East, and drawing in yet another thing, we have Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld's ideas about a new kind of war. And it seemed that in a lot of people's minds, maybe for different reasons, Iraq offered the possibility of testing all of these notions,
well, I think
all in one place.
Exactly. I think you put your finger on something very important and very revealing as to why the administration chose to fight this war in the place and time it did. It had to do with both demonstrating America's might, demonstrating the possibility of fostering democracy in the Middle East and building a stable, pro-Western, America-friendly regime in the heart of the Arab world in Iraq. And then finally, for Secretary Rumsfeld, it did hold out the potential to show that a major land campaign could be fought in a new way with integration of forces, lighter troops on the ground, more use of special forces and high-tech equipment, air power, surveillance, battlefield awareness, information technology, all of that. And so if wars are always the result of various constituencies contending for power, there were a number of constituencies in the American government, each of whom wanted to do this war for quite distinct reasons in some senses, and their interests combined in the post-September 11th aftermath. As you point out, there were people who for 10 years, a decade or more since the end of the last Gulf War, felt it was a big mistake to have left Saddam Hussein in power, that the United States really needed to finish that business.
Mm-hmm. Let us take this caller. I promised I wouldn't make them wait forever in Champaign on our line number one. Hello?
Hi.
Yes.
Well, in a sense, David, you've taken my question, but anyway, I'll ask it again, and we can elaborate more at the risk of being ostracized myself by the local leftists. But, everybody is saying, I personally don't believe that Saddam Hussein had anything to do with the bombing of the World Trade Center, but maybe it's a simplistic saying that my enemy's enemy is my friend, even if one has had a history originally of being a secular nationalist and the other enemy of the United States is an Islamist group of, a very violent one. It seems that, and Saddam Hussein did move towards, kind of using, Islamic rhetoric against Iran, who was using, which was already using lots of Islamist rhetoric, and even in the invasion of Kuwait, in terms of how he was going to be the hero that, brings together some Arab nation against, Israel. But, so that's my question then. I was going to bring up Ansar al-Islam in Kurdistan, and I didn't know for a fact that Hussein had was part of that, but it seemed logical that he would have some interest in stirring up trouble in Kurdistan. But I don't know whether his sons were involved in any of this or not. But so maybe there were some loose connections, but it seems that we've now, you know, drawn some lines in the sands, and now, you know, it's kind of black and white. You know, my enemy's enemy is my friend. When we look at the area near Baghdad that some people call the Sunni Triangle. So I'm just wondering then, you have these former Ba'athists and you have Mujahideen who maybe really don't have exactly the same interests, but they're working together. And so then you have local people and then some people coming in from outside that might be some kind of weak franchises, as well as perhaps Al-Ansar al-Islam. So I guess, do you think then that that we've strengthened the ties among Hussein and al-Qaeda, even though, you know, I don't believe that they were connected with...
I think the caller makes a really excellent point. It's entirely possible that whatever the connections between Saddam Hussein and Islamic fundamentalism before our invasion of Iraq, there are now clearly a number of fighters fighting in Iraq, fighting against the American occupation, who consider themselves part of a pan-Arab, pan-Islamic attempt to repulse infidel invaders as they see us and to defend Arab honor and the sort of concept of Iraqi nationalism. Now, of course, the Bush administration is quick to say that it wants to establish a new Iraqi government by Iraqis for Iraqis. But the reality is that in the short term, we are an occupying military power in a part of the world where occupying military powers have been an old story for centuries, and where that those occupations have left the local populace very wary of foreign involvement. But I think the point the caller makes is, yes, there's no doubt that Saddam Hussein was hostile to the United States. There's no doubt that he did not... he was not a friendly force in that part of the world, and he was up to no good. And the interesting question is whether by taking on his regime and toppling him as we did, we have now made that part of the world more congenial to our interests, or whether we have inflamed Arab sentiment against us. And it's possible that in the short term, we've done a little bit of both. And I think the future will be, you know, fascinating study in how that works out, and it's a tremendously big project for America to try to make it come out the right way.
Maybe I could just ask again then about, you talked about how pan-Islamism and pan-Arabism or nationalism are kind of sliding together, and one discourse that I see sliding together is they talked about how, you know, the knight, you know, Saddam Hussein, who always presented himself as this, quote, knight, as if he were fighting the Crusades, you know, that he went down very badly, and that upset a lot of people. But al-Qaeda also uses this, apparently Zawahiri's latest book, The Second in Command of al-Qaeda, is Knights Under the Banner of Muhammad. So this notion of the noble knight like Salah ad-Din, who, you know, practiced religious tolerance during the Crusades, is now being taken up by the terrorists.
Absolutely. I think you make a very good point.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. I want to ask one other question when we get back here with callers, because we were talking a little bit earlier about the many reasons that the administration had for going to war, how they were connected, and how not all of them were things that they talked about publicly, although there's a record on a lot of this. One of the things that the administration certainly did say when they were talking about the danger posed by Saddam Hussein and making that connection between the war on terror and Saddam Hussein, one of the things they certainly did talk about was weapons of mass destruction, his having them and his willingness to use them. Now, 7 months after the end of the war, so far, no evidence has been found of weapons of mass destruction. All they continue to look, and in fact, David Kaye, the man who is leading the hunt, has said recently, or at least there was a report recently that he said he was thinking about resigning. Where do things stand now in the search for weapons of mass destruction?
Well, it's a very interesting question, and in some ways it's the single greatest mystery of the whole war, the whole problem. which is if Saddam did not have these weapons of mass destruction, which, let's face it, at some level, in terms of chemical and biological weapons, the whole world assumed he had, if only because he hadn't accounted for what he'd done with ones we knew he had in the past and that he had used on his own people, that he'd used against the Kurds. If he didn't have them, why didn't he acknowledge that he didn't have them in a way that would satisfy the world and the sanctions and the ostracization of Iraq from the world community? A lot of speculation about that. Maybe now in our interrogations of Saddam we'll shed some light on it. Presumably he was afraid of losing face. Presumably he wanted to keep his own people in fear. Presumably he wanted to stand tall in the rest of the Arab world. A far larger question is what he had in the way of nuclear weapons programs. And as you know, there were people in the administration, Vice President Cheney and others, who felt you simply could not go wrong by overestimating what Saddam might be doing because past history had shown that we'd underestimated what he was doing. So these people were just determined to argue that he was on his way back to establishing a nuclear weapons program that could threaten us. It seems now in hindsight that he might have had nuclear scientists who still retain knowledge. He might have been trying to get fissile material, but there does not seem to be any evidence of an active nuclear program. And that's a problem for the administration in terms of justifying one key rationale for the war. It doesn't mean that he might not have been inclined to do this. It just means he wasn't apparently able or ready to do it tomorrow. And if David Kaye does in fact resign and the official effort to sort of find these weapons winds down without hitting pay dirt, it will be a very sort of unsatisfying end to the war, I think, in some ways, because no one will quite understand what the big deal was.
Yeah. Well, it seems that certainly this is something the administration has thought about, and it wasn't very long after going into Iraq and after the conclusion of the war, I think, the administration started in public pronouncements about why it is that the war was undertaken, started to shift its position and started to talk much less about weapons of mass destruction and talk more about the liberation of Iraq, the fact that here was the leader who abused his own people, their human rights, had a terrible record, was aggressive, a threat to the region. And so they started saying more and more publicly things very much like no one can, like members of the administration have said things like, well, no one can say that Iraq is not now better off because Saddam Hussein has been removed. And I guess then that makes me wonder just, they started making that shift a long time ago. If it turns out no weapons of mass destruction are found, how much of a problem is that really if they can, particularly if they can put more of the weight on the liberation kind of argument, whether that'll get them out of the trouble of the fact that maybe there aren't any weapons of mass destruction?
Yes, no, I mean, when I said it's a problem for them, I mean, I sort of meant, I guess, an intellectual or rhetorical problem. I'm not sure it's a big practical political problem, because the bottom line is Saddam Hussein is gone. We've captured him. We've solved that mystery. That regime is no more. Whatever comes next in Iraq will surely be somewhat better than what was there. I mean, I suppose the great fear is there could arise some kind of Islamic fundamentalist government that would be totally hostile to the United States, possibly be dangerous, possibly try to develop weapons of mass destruction or nuclear weapons all over again. But as you point out, the administration has long ago taken to saying, President Bush last summer was basically saying weapons or weapons programs, trying to sort of say whether he had the actual weapons or merely the capacity to build them and the desire to get them, it's almost the same thing. It reminds me a little bit of the period leading up to the war when, as you suggest, the administration's rationale for war seemed to change almost daily or weekly depending on who was doing the talking. Sometimes it was global terrorism, sometimes it was weapons of mass destruction, sometimes it was democracy in the Middle East, sometimes it was the security of Israel and a post, you know, Saddam era would be the way to have a peaceful resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. So, yes, I think the administration has long been used to sort of throwing the spaghetti at the wall and see what would stick in terms of its arguments. It just means that I think for historians and for people who try to sort this all out, it will be a very interesting question to try to resolve.
We have other callers. We'll get right to them. Let me introduce again our guest, Todd Purdom. He is correspondent in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times and has worked for the Times for more than 20 years. He is a former diplomatic correspondent. He was a White House correspondent. He also was bureau chief of the L.A. Bureau. And he is the author of a new book titled A Time of Our Choosing, America's War in Iraq, published by Times Books. And we will go next to Champaign County for the next caller, line two. Hello.
Hi. It's quite distressing to me that a Washington correspondent for the New York Times cannot just say that one of the possibilities is they knowingly lied. There's massive cases of Washington malfeasance at high levels. Where can you say Gulf of Tonkin? You know, the war was lied into, and it's pretty clear it was done knowingly at this point. It's distressing that you'd cut them so much slack that, you know, it's just sort of, we were just establishing the worst case scenario, et cetera, as you put it. That's my interpretation. So I find it extremely distressing that you won't even sort of allow that's one of the possibilities. I mean, the Times, basically, with Judith Miller, who the other day on Charlie Rose says that actually let it slip that she regarded herself as serving with her boys, her military. I mean, she basically was carrying water for this whole thing. So I just think that it's pretty explicit. I do have another question, but you might want to say something about that.
Well, I guess I'd just say that I find it somewhat distressing that as a caller, you leap to the assumption that of what my beliefs are. No one has asked me yet in this program whether I think we were misled into the war. No one has asked me whether I think the administration lied. If that's what you're asking me, I'll answer that I do not think it was so much a case of the administration choosing to directly mislead the public or to lie to the public. I think there were clearly people in the administration who, in hindsight, made unjustifiable cases of the immediacy and urgency of this threat. But I think it came, I'm willing to say that it came from a sincere motivation on their part, that they believed with fervor and deep intellectual consistency, as they saw it, that America had been gulled in the past, had been lulled into a false sense of security, that after the last Persian Gulf War, we found out how much closer Saddam Hussein had been to developing nuclear weapons than we ever thought. A person like Vice President Cheney would personally go to the CIA in the last couple of years, question the agents. Now, some of them felt that amounted to pressure. Some of them felt that was improper meddling. Some of them felt they were being pushed to tailor their conclusions to his political desires, and I recount that fully in the book.
Well, you're scolding me for
I'm not scolding you, sir. I don't want to get in an argument with you.
Well, you've
impugned my honor, and I don't feel my honor is up for grabs. If you want to ask a question, I'm happy to answer it, but I'm not the one who came on the phone with a hectoring tone. I'm not trying to scold you at all. I'm trying to answer your question as honestly as I can and say that if you ask me, I do not think the administration overtly and consciously misled the American public. I think the administration put a dark spin on the knowable facts, which were precious few, and in hindsight, they clearly overestimated the threat in some aspects. There will turn out to be other ways in which we didn't even know how bad the threat was. I'm sure there will be other things that will come to light in the months and years ahead that will make us wonder why we didn't know that. But I'm just answering your question as calmly as I can.
Well, I'm saying, maybe I scold you, I reacted to, but basically I understood your point of view, and I'm still distressed by it because it's pretty clear to me from looking at the documentations of the platform of the Republican Party called for the getting rid of Saddam Hussein. So, you know,
Well, I guess I can only say that's what makes America a fabulous country, that people can look at the same set of facts and have different views. And I'm sorry if you feel that mine is inadequate, and I'm certainly not forcing my interpretation on you, and I'm not forcing anything else on you.
Well,
if the caller had a question, maybe it'd be more productive if you go ahead and ask your question and see if we can get an answer. And then we got a lot of other callers.
Okay, well, I am challenging the whole New York Times too, because Judith Miller was pivotal in this. And
well, I can't speak for the whole New York Times. I'm one member of a 1,000-person news staff, and I'm very proud to be part of it. But I can't speak for all my colleagues or the institutional failings of my paper, which I'm sure are real and manifold.
Well, let's go back to the whole linkage and what's being done on the ground in Iraq. I understand one of the incarceration centers for a variety of Iraqi prisoners, I just heard an interview with a Palestinian guy that was there for 6 months, is named after a fireman at the World Trade Center and has pictures of the devastation of the World Trade Center throughout the prison. I mean, this is using. In fact, they were discussing attacking Iraq on September 12th, 2001. This was an opportunity for them. It's crass. It's using the death of all those people in a absolutely cold-blooded and disgusting manner. And I will defer to the other callers.
Well, in fairness, I do recount very fully those post-September 11 discussions about the rationale, and I recount very fully how some policymakers in the administration thought this was an opportunity to deal with a problem. As to naming, you know, a detention camp for a firefighter from 911, that strikes me as of dubious propriety and not the useful kind of message you want to send in that part of the world. Look, I mean, I make no defense of the Bush administration's handling of this whole matter. This book is in no sense pro-war. It's in no sense anti-war. It's meant to be descriptive and as dispassionate as is possible to be, holding out all the possible options. And I deal at the very end of the book with the possibility that this was all simply a bum deal, and that it was all a misinterpretation. So anyway, I can only encourage you to read the book. You obviously are a faithful Times reader. You're very well versed in the situation, and I hope you'll find that over time we continue to cover this story diligently, and that the truth somehow emerges from the bulk of our work.
Well, again, we have a number of callers. We're moving into about our last 20 minutes. Folks can help us if they're brief. We'll just keep on here. Next, go to Urbana, and that's line 3. Hello.
Good morning. I'm not going to say anything to impugn your honor. I just wanted to ask about something that I heard over the weekend. I heard that there had been a Reuters report that in the area around Tikrit, demonstrating or speaking against the U.S. government had been made illegal. And I hadn't heard that on any of the major news networks, and I was wondering if you could speak to the truthfulness of that and also to the implications that would have for the purported goal of bringing about democracy in Iraq.
I can't speak to the truth of that. I've been on vacation, and I'm not up to speed on the latest reports from the ground in Iraq. I could say that it strikes me, if it's true, as completely idiotic. I mean, I'm sure that it might have, if it is true, it probably has some basis or some justification in the notion that public demonstrations against the occupation were coming to be seen as threatening or destabilizing and so forth and so on. But as you know, the answer for a grudge in these circumstances is more free speech, and that's the American creed. It's what America believes more deeply than anything. So if somehow occupying forces in Iraq made it illegal to speak out against the American occupation, then I think that's counterproductive. But I haven't heard that report, and I can't speak to it. I know Reuters is a very reliable agency. That's all I can say.
Would you have any thoughts on why that wouldn't have been picked up by the major networks? And I didn't hear it on NPR either.
I don't know. I don't think it would be for lack of interest in it. I mean, the problem is, as you know, in a situation like this in Iraq, it's very chaotic. There's limited communications capability still. There are all kinds of competing demands on reporters' times. The environment's not particularly safe to move around in or work. It could be that other organizations are trying independently to confirm this. It could be that it appeared in some place that you and I didn't happen to see or hear, but I don't think it's because of any effort on the part of the broader American media to suppress it. If that's true, I'm sure that will ultimately get plenty of attention, because it's a kind of, it seems like a counterproductive thing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call.
Let's go to Charleston next, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I'll pose my statement or question in historical and philosophical terms. Say the U.S., you know, now, if I'm hearing and reading everything properly, is to establish democracy and freedom in Iraq. Well, if we take that as a goal, and we perceive we'll have Iraq looking like the U.S. and the Middle East in its entirety and the rest of the world, the provisions that democracy supposedly are putting forth as desirable, and we are so shortchanged in the U.S. in within these borders, where extreme poverty, racism, and economic hegemony, where the money goes into fewer and fewer hands, and suddenly we're going to take this these ideas and stick them on other people, and then they're going to have all the benefits of democracy, which I think is an inadvertent lie, and then suddenly this is going to work in another foreign country where communalism and the Islamic faith is has great power. I think it's ridiculous to think that we are going to accomplish that. We're there for one reason, oil. Thank you.
All right.
Well, I think the caller makes a number of excellent points. I do think, starting with the end, I think we're there for more than one reason. I think clearly oil is part of the equation, but I think we're there for more than one reason. But I think his eloquent statement of the difficulty of honoring and making real democracy here at home, much less exporting it to a country half a world away, which has absolutely no tradition of democracy, no tradition of democratic institutions, he distills very nicely the enormous challenge, in some ways, the enormous arrogance of America's presumption that it can do this in Iraq. And frankly, one of the biggest concerns that I've had in spending the time on this book and covering the story is that this is one of the biggest ideas any American president has ever articulated as a goal for the country. And yet President Bush seems so reluctant to really ask much sacrifice from American, except for families of soldiers and reservists and National Guardsmen who are serving in Iraq. But in terms of expecting that the American people, in the form of higher taxes or other kinds of burdens, should really take a share of making democracy work in Iraq, he hasn't asked for that yet, and it's almost as if he's afraid to ask for it because he knows what a tall order it is. So I think the caller makes a totally valid point.
It's clear that the administration is hoping to, in some substantial way, disengage and have Iraqis governing Iraq before next year's presidential election.
I think that's absolutely clear now.
And that they were hoping by the spring somehow that this provisional Iraqi governing body would be in place and essentially making the decisions. And I guess there's a big question about, you know, whether or not that's possible and how much the United States would have to continue to be involved. I guess I wonder how the administration thinks and what they say both privately and publicly about how long and to what extent there would have to be an American presence in Iraq.
Well, you know, the administration has said a lot of things about that. One of the formulations President Bush and others have said repeatedly is that we'll be there as long as it takes and not a day longer. I would say there's a big fear now in certain circles in Washington that the administration will, for domestic political reasons here at home, try to pull out too quickly, and that the risk is Iraq will descend into some kind of chaos without clear governance and without clear, stable institutions. If there were elections in Iraq tomorrow, it could be a potential disaster because there are no established institutions, free press, rule of law, those kinds of things that are the necessary precedent to a functioning democracy. So I think one of the other questions is, if an Iraqi government is established, how long might American troops stay there in a kind of garrison sense to provide security on demand? I mean, we would be there sort of at the invitation of the new Iraqi government instead of as an occupying power. I think at some level there's every reason to expect that significant numbers of American troops might be in Iraq for decades to come, just as they are in North Korea or as they were in the Philippines. I mean, I think that remains a very, very lively possibility, and we'll just have to see what happens.
Hmm. Next caller is in Chicago, line one.
Hi.
Yes.
Several weeks ago, there was an article in the New Yorker by the Pulitzer Prize winner, whose name I forget.
Seymour Hersh?
Yeah, by Hersh. I've seen nor heard not one word of comment on the article. And normally, these New Yorker articles receive a lot of comment and publicity. And I don't know if you've read the article, but in any case, he dealt with the formation of a separate spy organization to replace the CIA and the State Department and other such organizations, and in order to confirm to back up the policy of the administration, claiming that they had no confidence in the CIA, nor the State Department, nor any other organization then in existence in the U.S. government, which were contradicting the basic position of Cheney and company. And this goes back to the period prior to 9/11.
This is a special unit in the Pentagon headed by Douglas Feith. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
I would only say, sir, I don't know if our paper or others directly commented on Cy Hirsch's article, but we have extensively covered this issue and extensively covered this ongoing rather intense debate within the intelligence community about the propriety of this, the necessity of this, whether it makes sense, whether it's right, and I do think we've covered this issue pretty thoroughly.
Can I interrupt?
Sure.
I read the New York Times also fairly thoroughly, and I understand the Times covers these positions, but not as it doesn't pull the pieces together the way Hirsch did, and this is what makes Hirsch's article so valuable. And there are always bits and pieces coming out, and there's hardly ever a unification of all the information that's around in order to, you know.
Well, you make a valid point, and I'm sure that it's one that our editors, you know, would be inclined to look on with favor. And you know, you're certainly fair to say that daily newspaper journalism has a tendency to lay out the pieces of the mosaic. Sometimes we're not so good at putting the whole mosaic in perspective in the same way that you can in a longer magazine article. So I'd certainly be happy to pass on your point to my supervisors and let them know that there's a feeling that perhaps this is an issue we should explore more.
Yeah, it's not only that, but Hirsch has information in his article that I haven't seen anywhere else.
Well, that's why he's the reporter he is. I mean,
as
you know, he once worked for us, and he broke the My Lai massacre story.
Yeah.
You know,
that was a Pulitzer Prize thing.
So in any case, he's a pretty diligent, skilled guy.
One more item, and this is that I think what ought to be, in order to at least to better understand the present condition in Iraq and in the United States, American politics and Texas politics and so on, people ought to read the three-volume biography by Cairo of LBJ. And although I won't go so far as to state that Halliburton was the reason for our going into Iraq, at least it's a point of view. There are billions of dollars. Halliburton was on the ropes until 9/11, and now they're going to make billions off of this Iraq contract.
You won't get any quarrel from me by endorsing Bob Cairo's books. They're spectacular. So.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We have here about 10 minutes left. I guess I should just introduce again one more time our guest, Todd Purdom. He's correspondent in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times and has worked for the paper for more than 20 years. He's the author of a recently published book that does try to pull together the story, drawing on some of the reporting, a lot of the reporting done by the other people working at the Times. His book is titled A Time of Our Choosing, the subtitle America's War in Iraq. It's published by Times Books and is out now. We'll go on here to next caller over by Danville, Belgium, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning. I have a question with the way that the reporting has gone along. It seems as though the American administrations back in the Reagan-Bush era and then on with the Bush era after that bought a bad dog when they started dealing with Saddam Hussein and dealing with the Iran problems back in the early 90s. And then they gave him weapons to deal with this problem. That's tantamount to teasing a dog and making him want to bite. You're responsible for these actions. And now they've brought it all the way back to us and tried to blame it on 9/11. Seems the first Bush and the second Bush have got an agenda here that just takes care of their vendettas that they have from the past.
Well, one of the interesting points you make is that in the 1980s, Saddam was, we saw him as our friend and as a if not a particularly admirable guy, at least someone who would be a bulwark against Islamic fundamentalism in Iran. And indeed, on the day that American troops last April made their first so-called thunder run into Baghdad on Saturday, April 5th, some of the equipment they faced, a lot of it was Soviet-era tanks, a lot of it was French and German and Italian-made, but some of it was American-made, which had been there ever since we sold and gave it to Iraq in the 80s. So I can't speak to whatever kind of personal agenda the Bush family may be working out here about this, although I did write an article about that last week just in terms of the vindication that they obviously feel at Saddam Hussein's capture. But the reality of the world and of world politics is that you sometimes find yourselves in bed with the strangest people, and then when the worm turns a little bit, you find yourselves fighting those same people whose interests have ceased to coincide with yours. And you make a very fair point that, you know, we have not always been clear-eyed about the menace that Saddam Hussein posed to the world, and it's something America will have to live with.
Well, didn't we, in effect, actually just activate some of this thing? We didn't give him direction when it came to Kuwait. We didn't seem to show him that we didn't mind that we came into Kuwait. We didn't seem to mind that he gassed his relatives to the north.
Well, now you're raising a whole bunch of issues which would be worth a book all on their own, and I'm not inclined to quarrel with anything that you say, only to say that really I can't adequately deal with it in the context of this brief radio conversation because you've tapped into a whole series of very complex and very interesting issues which are not easily summed up. But the short answer is yes.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Well, that's, I guess, one of the things that I wonder about is whether people in Washington are concerned that when Saddam Hussein is put on trial, that somehow in his defense, people will say, well, he had been supported by the United States. And I'm sure that they'll pull out pictures of a smiling Saddam Hussein sitting next to a smiling Don Rumsfeld,
who was then President Reagan's Mideast envoy.
Exactly. And people who are defending him, if they had the chance, would say, but look here, the United States was supporting this man. So somehow the United States is responsible for ultimately how that went. I mean, you know, I can imagine somebody making that argument. Do you think that there are people in Washington who are concerned that they're going to have to be dealing with that when Saddam Hussein is put on trial?
I think there are people who are concerned about that. I'm sure that's why some people in the administration are particularly concerned not to let the trial of Saddam Hussein proceed in some kind of international tribunal where, you know, Europeans or others would be interested in making those very points. I think the administration is resolved to the fact that will all be brought up as part of history, and they're still prepared to say that the cold light of day will show that the administration did the right thing in toppling Saddam, and that all that was true enough in terms of America's involvement with him in the past, but that his dealings with the world community had descended to the point where we had no choice.
Let's go to Newman, Illinois. That's next. Caller, line 3. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call this morning. I really enjoy your talk here. I have a reality question, I guess. I have a tape of President Bush. It was before we went into Iraq, and he's saying, well, imagine if Saddam had these weapons, and imagine, you know, what he could do. Well, I think the agenda was already set, and they just needed the justification for the American people to get behind it. You know, just imagine, you know, imagine how terrible this would be. We got to take care of it.
I do think there's a lot to what you say. I mean, I think at some level, for reasons that are complex and reasons that are brutally simple, President Bush decided it was time to take on Saddam Hussein, and the questions that followed were questions basically of salesmanship and timing,
right,
and how to persuade people to support it, how to get the best support from the international community, how to get support from Congress. But I think certainly from the spring and summer of 2002 on, there was virtually no doubt that President Bush was bent on a course that would lead to war in Iraq, and then the challenge began to be how to sell the war, not how to, not whether to do it.
Right. Do you think in your opinion, was the agenda perhaps already in motion even before 9/11?
I think that's a harder question to answer. It wasn't at the public level. We don't know some of the classified documents. We might not for a long time. President Bush had certainly not made a big point about Iraq in his presidential campaign. Iraq policy was in the process of undergoing a review. Secretary of State Colin Powell had tried to win support for a new version of sanctions against Iraq at the United Nations. There were people like Paul Wolfowitz and others who had very, very dark views of Iraq, but I think it's a little bit doubtful that Iraq was at the top of the president's own agenda before 9/11.
Okay, well, thank you. I've really enjoyed
your call.
All right. Well, thanks for the show. Thanks for the call. We're almost out of time. One quick question, sort of peripheral. I wanted to ask. Some months back, there was a rumor circulating that Colin Powell had decided that if President Bush was reelected, that he, Mr. Powell, would not continue as Secretary of State. Now, publicly, he has said, no, that's not, there's nothing to that. And I guess I just wonder from what you hear and what people talk about in Washington, D.C., whether there is the thought that, in fact, that that's true, that if if the president's reelected, they're going to have to find a new Secretary of State.
I think there's every reason to think that if the president's reelected, they'll have to find a new Secretary of State, partly because Colin Powell is now 66 or perhaps 67 years old. He just underwent prostate surgery for prostate cancer. He's got every sign of recovering well. But he's a guy who's given more than 40 years of his life one way or another to his country, and he's ready for some time with his Volvos and his family. And I think it's been a frustrating experience for him, no doubt, serving in this administration. His views have sometimes, even maybe you might say often, not prevailed. But he's a loyal lieutenant to his commander-in-chief. He's a military man to his corps. And I think he's served as faithfully and loyally as he feels he can. But I wouldn't be surprised at all. I would be very surprised if he stayed on in a second term.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time today.
Thanks a lot, and happy holidays. It's always a pleasure. I'm from Macomb, so being on the air in Urbana-Champaign is very satisfying to me.
It's a small world, isn't it? Todd Burnham is our guest. He's correspondent in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. The book, if you're interested in looking at it, is titled A Time of Our Choosing, America's War in Iraq, by Todd Burnham and the staff of the New York Times, published by Times Books.